Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes New York Times bestselling author Laura Lippman for the launch of Sunburn, a superb novel of psychological suspense about two people locked in a passionate yet uncompromising game of cat and mouse with dark secrets, forbidden desires, inevitable betrayals, and cold-blooded murder. Friday, February 23rd at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rogics, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking for Friday, the 16th day of February. Coming up on this Weekender show, how to make a better Bloody Mary, the classic brunchtime drink that, according to a recent survey, is one of the three most popular cocktails in Maryland. Baltimore bartender Brendan Doyle will be sharing his secret for a better Bloody Mary. That's in the second half of today's episode. But first things first. So we are confronted today, in a very clear way, if it wasn't already clear, with a country whose so-called leaders cannot resolve big problems, the violence wreaked by military-style guns, and the dilemma of immigrants who came into the United States as children, but who, as young adults, face deportation. We have a president who spends a lot of time talking about the dangers posed by immigrants when the biggest threats of violence to Americans come from other Americans. Listen to Sergio Rosenblatt, the father of a student from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. He was on Andrea Mitchell's show yesterday on MSNBC.
And if President Trump really means it, show leadership. Do something. Do something. Come here. Now, don't come here and throw paper towels like in Puerto Rico. You know, the wall's not going to protect me. I'm not afraid of a Mexican invasion. I'm afraid of kids going into school with AR-15s and doing this again and again and again and again. And then we're all going to be here, and then it's all going to disappear until the next clip. And that's my point. Do something. Stop talking. Rubio, grow some. Do something. Nelson, do something. The rest of Congress, do something. Until your kids get shot, then you're going to do something. Is that what it's going to take? I don't get it. This is not the America I came 50 years ago. And I love this country. I don't know this country anymore. I don't understand it. I don't know how to explain it.
I know, and a lot of other Americans know, how Mr. Rosenblatt feels. Just the other morning, walking along Center Street in Baltimore from the bus stop to work, I was thinking about how bad things are. I was thinking specifically about drug addiction and the deadly opioid epidemic, but also about violence and guns and how there's just so much of both. We think we are an exceptional country, leader of the free world, and by some measures we are, but we have some big internal problems. And the failure to deal with them in big, once-and-for-all ways keeps us from reaching the American ideal. We'd like to have a better country, but we are so divided and so lacking in bold leadership. Yesterday, while the nation's attention was focused on Parkland, Florida, the Senate in Washington was unable, again, to come up with a deal on immigration reform. And a result of that stalemate is the very real threat of deportation for young adults known as the Dreamers, hundreds of thousands of them. Democrats were unable to give ground to the Trump proposals, which take a hard line on legal immigration. And Republican leaders were unable to muster their own senators because they think giving Dreamers a break, putting them on the road to citizenship, amounts to amnesty. And Republican senators and members of the House all worry about losing elections over embracing a policy that Ronald Reagan supported 30 years ago. But that was then, this is now, and now is one screwed up time in this country's history. And I wish I had the recipe, the secret formula for making it all better. I'll have more thoughts about this in my Sunday column in The Sun. Today, in the face of all this bad news, the school shooting in Florida, the stalemate over immigration reform, leaving the Dreamers in limbo, we take a minute to appreciate what immigrants have meant to the country, specifically in terms of the food we eat. There's a new cookbook out called simply The Immigrant Cookbook, a celebration of what makes America great. The book contains dozens of recipes from immigrants from all over the world, and part of the proceeds from the sale of each book benefits an immigrants' rights project. I thought you'd like to hear about it. The book is published by Interlink, the publisher of Soup for Syria. The profits from the sales of that book went to refugee relief efforts through the United Nations. Leila Mushabek is Interlink's cookbook editor, and she collected and edited the recipes in the Immigrant Cookbook.
You know, food is really central and fundamentally important element to any culture. So it can be really an intimate way to learn about another person and to interact with another place. And so, you know, when reading the stories and cooking the dishes in the book, you know, you can really connect with another culture, and you're inviting it into your home, to share in your own family traditions, and you're gaining a small glimpse into another person's experience. Sometimes, like, simple encounters like that can really go a long way towards promoting understanding. When we asked each of the contributors for a recipe that's important to them and that they connect with their immigrant experience, so many of them told stories of family gatherings or memories of helping out in the kitchen with favorite relatives, or, you know, really early experiences of home. And so, you know, they're really emotional recipes, and the book brings together such a diverse range of cuisines and voices, but at the same time, if you read them side by side, you find these threads of common experience, which I found really inspiring, because there's a kind of unifying aspect to the book that has a really important message, particularly right now. Immigrants have helped shape American food culture since the earliest days of the country, bringing ingredients, foods, cooking methods to almost all the foods that we think of as being American dishes originated with an immigrant community, you know, pizza and hamburgers and apple pie and
apple pie.
So many.
Wait a minute. What do you mean apple pie? I thought that as American as apple pie, isn't that the expression?
Yeah, but it has origins of, I think, German immigrants to this country.
And probably British. I mean, people don't want to hear that because they think it was invented here.
I mean, I suppose that there are simultaneous foods and flavors that cropped up in different places. And things get adapted once they're here and built on them. So a lot of amazing cuisines have come out of cultural collision and trying things out with new ingredients. And, you know, today, so many of our top chefs at the forefront of American food culture are first or second generation immigrants. So in terms of the food we eat, the impact is really huge. From an economic perspective, immigration has huge implications for our food industry. Immigrants, kind of legal as well as undocumented, make up the majority of the labor force of our farms, food factories, our grocery stores, our restaurant kitchens. And I think this contribution is often overlooked when discussing immigration policy.
Well, let's talk about some of the recipes in the book. I picked out five or six that looked really appealing to me. Actually, they all looked interesting and like something I might try to cook, but we can't talk about all of them. So here's the first one I picked. Its origin is India. It's called dal palak, lentil and spinach soup.
It's a recipe by Harry Nayak, who's a chef and cookbook author. He's a restaurateur and he's a food consultant from South India, known for vegetarian cooking. And this recipe is inspired by kind of traditional comfort food dish dal palak. But he mentions that you can really use whatever you have in the fridge to make this soup. It's warming. It's beautifully spiced with cumin, garlic, ginger, uses garam masala, turmeric, has a kind of tomato in there and kind of a rich creaminess from coconut milk. You can have it as a kind of light, kind of healthy one bowl meal, or you can serve it with rice or naan to kind of make it a little heartier. So it's a really beautiful, just a really great representation of a kind of comforting universal dish that everyone can enjoy.
The next chef, Ivan Garcia, who must be a very busy guy, he's the chef and owner of, it looks like, three restaurants in Brooklyn, a native of Mexico City. Yeah. This dish is Garibaldi-style pozole rojo. This involves a savory pork dish that's served on holidays in Mexico.
Yeah, he describes it's a sort of celebration dish of big family gatherings. It also features two really central ingredients to Mexico. Mexican cuisine, which is corn and hot chili peppers, and it uses three different varieties of dried chilies to make a base, a sort of stock base for the boneless pork shoulder. What I love about this dish in particular is that you use the pork and hominy corn, which is a more savory, larger corn kernel than we have usually here in the U.S., as a sort of base, and then you serve the dish with a variety of different ingredients that have different textures, like lettuce, radish, avocados, lime wedges, and you can kind of garnish the dish as you like. Yeah. And I love that because every spoonful has, you know, 5-6 different textures and flavors.
Let's go to Taiwan next. This is Mama Chang's hot and sour soup. Photograph looks great. The contributor is Joanne Chang. She's from Taiwan.
Yes, and this is actually a really good recipe to start with if you're not particularly familiar with Taiwanese and Asian food in general, because it is really easy. Joanne Chang has a really successful sort of small chain of bakeries and cafes in the Boston area. And this dish is a hot and sour soup that comes from, that is her mom's recipe that her mom used to make for her and her brother when she was growing up. It's really beautiful because if you've, you know, had hot and sour soup before, it's a little bit smoother than that. It uses slightly more widely available ingredients. It uses ground pork and button mushrooms, and it uses egg as a thickener rather than cornstarch. So it's a really lovely version of the dish and really flavorful. She says it always sells out in her bakeries. She's put it on her menu, and it's a really nice example of how these chefs kind of carry these childhood recipes through their careers.
I cook the things my mother cooked.
Yeah, I mean, we all do, don't we?
We do, yeah. And not just for nostalgia, but because they're good. Recipes are good.
Yeah.
Next stop is Pakistan. I like the sounds of this dish. It's Mughlai fish curry. The contributor is Zareen Khan, who is a chef.
She has one of the kind of few well-known Pakistani restaurants in the country. She actually has two locations in California. This is a really lovely fish curry that she says the secret lies in choosing the freshest fish possible, and she pairs it with really ripe and sweet tomatoes. And you can use whole fish or steaks or pieces in this curry, whatever you prefer. I think traditionally it's whole fish. It's spiced with garlic, ginger, coriander, cayenne, turmeric, chili, cloves, fenugreek, and she also rounds it out with yogurt to give it really lovely creamy texture. And you serve it with simply plain basmati rice, and it's a really lovely spiced curry. It's another really great weeknight meal when you don't have a ton of time, but you really want something special.
Next, Ethiopia, Dora Watt, spicy Ethiopian chicken stew.
This is a recipe contributed by Tiona Balete, who came to the U.S. in the 80s to pursue her higher education. Like many of the contributors in the book, when she was far away from home, discovered her passion for cooking, the kind of dishes of her upbringing. She opened an Ethiopian restaurant in Maryland, as well as a small-batch gourmet Ethiopian food company that brings sort of Ethiopian flavors and flair to the American market. Dora Watt is a really traditional Ethiopian dish. She says it's the national dish of Ethiopia and brings a lot of childhood memories for her. And it's a really special kind of celebration dish that kind of brings families and communities together. And she cooks it, she feels, to kind of connect with her culture at home. And it's flavored with berberi, which is a hot sea Ethiopian spice mixture, which you can find ready-made in grocery stores. It's quite a slow-cooked stew, so it takes quite a while, but it's very easy to do.
The restaurant that she owns in Maryland, it's Rockville, Maryland, is called Sheba. Okay, there's one more that I'm going to ask you about. Ron Duprat, this is a recipe from Haiti. He's been on Top Chef, Iron Chef America. Anyway, the recipe he's contributed here is, it looks so beautiful. It's an island salad, but it's so colorful and fresh looking. It's got cabbage, scallions, red bell peppers, red onion. It's so healthy looking, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really lovely light. It's called island slaw. The Haitian cuisine combines a blend of different cooking styles and is strongly influenced by Afro-Cuban as well as French culinary traditions. And this is a hot slaw that would be great for kind of a barbecue or alongside fish dishes. He has hot pepper as well, if you like, but you can leave it out if you don't like a really hot flavor. And there's a beautiful dressing that uses yogurt and lime juice, cider vinegar, and some spices. So it's a little bit lighter than the coleslaw you might be used to.
Layla, nice job in this cookbook. It's a real adventure. I mean, it's not Italian, it's not Mexican, it's not Thai, it's all of this. There's a little bit of everything from all around the world and food that you can find in the United States because of our immigrant culture, immigrant contributions. That's why it's called the Immigrant Cookbook.
Yeah.
Once again, about the proceeds.
We're donating a minimum of $5 from the sale of each book to the ACLU specifically for their immigrants' rights project. This work is just increasingly important at this point.
Leila, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leila Mushabek is Interlink's cookbook editor, and she collected and edited the recipes in the Immigrant Cookbook. Okay, I promise to end today's show with a recipe for a better Bloody Mary. Let's get to it. Brendan Dorr is back with us again, Baltimore bartender, president of the Baltimore Bartenders Guild from the B&O American Brasserie. And he's sitting across from me in the studio concocting a Bloody Mary for me.
I'm going to make a Bloody Mary the way I like Bloody Marys okay. to taste.
All right. The reason you're doing this is because I asked you to do this because we published a survey that came out from Versus Reviews based on data from Google searches. They were looking at the most popular cocktails in every state in the country.
Yes.
And Maryland showed up as favoring mimosas, tequila sunrises. Boy, that takes me back. Tequila takes me back to college. And Bloody Marys, the most popular drinks in several states, including Maryland, which all those strike me as sort of brunch drinks.
Yeah.
A mimosa, definitely. A Bloody Mary, definitely. Tequila sunrise, I guess so. But anyway, are you surprised by these results? Do you get asked for Bloody Marys a lot at the B&O?
We get asked for Bloody Marys a decent amount of the time.
Yeah. What time of day? Like lunch?
Mostly lunchtime, brunch. But I will say I was still fairly surprised that the Bloody Mary was the one that we get the most of. I mean,
I don't know what to make of that. You know, the other drinks that were popular, the Moscow Mule showed up as being pretty popular, but also Long Island iced teas and whiskey sours. Whiskey sour doesn't surprise me.
Whiskey sour doesn't surprise me. I'm not surprised by that at all.
But Long Island iced tea?
Long Island iced tea.
Several states have that.
I mean, I think, you know, I definitely work in a bar that is not quite the norm, if you know what I mean. You know, we're not your just average Joe kind of bar.
No, definitely not.
So we get people who...
you have full lunch, full dinner, and you have brunch on the weekends.
Exactly. So... I think we get...
I guess we ought to talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah, so we get all kinds of things. But, my opinion is the Bloody Mary still belongs as a morning, afternoon, daytime kind of cocktail.
Yeah.
You know, to each his own, drink what you want when you want.
I can't get out of my mind that it is a brunch, a Sunday morning
brunch drink.
If I'm watching the Olympics,
something
perfect
time.
Right in the middle of the day,
sure.
Sunday or Saturday, maybe a Bloody Mary, and I don't take the trouble to make them very much. As much as I like them,
sure.
I had an old friend Calvert Bragel who loved Bloody Marys, and that was his specialty, and he prided himself on how well he made it, and he did make a good one.
All right.
And it was fast acting, I must say.
All right.
What have you done? Why don't you describe what you've been doing for the last couple minutes while we've been talking here?
So I brought some of our Bloody Mary mix that we make at B&O. We don't use a pre-batched anything.
Okay. So is that a secret recipe?
I wouldn't say it's a secret recipe. I mean, I think it's a fairly standard recipe. We've doctored the way we want it. We do have a blend of spices that it's a variety of different things that we put in it.
Okay. You don't have to get into the spices if you don't want it. But what do you start with? Do you start with, like, diced tomatoes?
We use just a good quality tomato juice.
Okay.
So nothing crazy special. From there, we build on the flavors. You know, we like Worcestershire in ours, fresh horseradish in ours, salt, pepper, lemon juice. But then the spices are what I think really help, you know, make our tomato juice, our Bloody Mary mix.
Pardon my ignorance. Is horseradish a standard part of the blend of
it? It depends, you know. I think the horseradish, the ingredient of horseradish, is a bit of a regional thing. I mean, I'm from Maryland, and most bars I've ever worked at, all have horseradish in there
in
the recipe. So here's our mix.
All right, I'm just going to taste Brendan's mix sans distilled beverages here, which is sort of the whole point. But okay, let me taste the mix.
All right, go for it.
Mmm, that is so delicious.
Yeah,
I could drink this as is and be very happy.
Yep.
Well, I could be happier, I guess, if you actually made it Bloody Mary. But this is really good.
Thank you. Well, like
seafood, oysters.
Oysters.
There's horseradish in this, right?
It's the horseradish is probably what you're getting.
You know what I'm getting? You know what I'm getting? I'm getting Fadley's raw oyster bar as I sip this.
Excellent.
Because I put horseradish and a little hot sauce
on your oysters.
Yeah, salt and pepper and lemon. I put
whole
thing.
You doctor them up.
I associate your Bloody Mary mix with slurping an oyster because that's how I prepare my oysters.
Well, anyway. I'm just going to say thank you because people like that place so much that that's definitely
it's a good association.
Okay. Yes.
Now, so what have you done since we've been sitting here?
So I've been holding my drink, waiting to taste it. No, so what I put in here besides the B&O House Bloody Mary mix, we keep ours pretty simple. We don't doctor it up with a lot of things coming out of the glass. We like you to just go in and get the raw, delicious experience of a well-made Bloody Mary. So obviously, typically, Bloody Marys are made with vodka. But I like a nice amount of peaty scotch in my Bloody Mary.
Holy cow.
That smokiness mixed in there, oh, it's delicious. It almost makes it real like meaty, if that makes sense. Like smoked and charred, right off the grill kind of thing, but in a glass.
What did you mean by peaty scotch?
So peaty scotch, peat is a type of moss.
Mm-hmm.
And in Islay.
As in peat moss.
Peat moss.
Okay.
On Islay, which is a small island that's part of Scotland, they are known for peat-driven Scotch whiskies.
Okay.
So
today we're using
Laphroaig 10-year. I just grabbed a little something from the house, and this stuff is just pure peat. It's got a little subtleties to it, but it gets the job done when you want some peat in it.
So you like that in the Bloody Mary because it adds this sort of earthy, smoky.
Yeah, exactly. What do you taste?
Okay.
So we finish at B&O, we finish ours with just like an olive and a lemon wedge or like a lemon wheel like this.
A black olive or green olive?
Green olive. Mm-hmm. And then just a fresh ground pepper.
And lemon wedge and fresh ground pepper. Okay.
Yeah.
He's got the lemon. And should I squeeze this
if
lemon
you want
before
to? There's already some lemon in it, but yeah, go for it.
All right.
I'm going to.
Okay. Here's looking at you. Salute. Oh, I see what you mean about the scotch. Now, that's a really interesting. Holy cow. There's all kinds of things going on in my mouth right now and up my nose. Wow. Well, first of all, that's a really interesting scotch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not experienced with that. I had no idea to expect that kind of smoky, earthy.
It's.
Wow.
But it.
I like it. I'm just saying. I'm not expecting that.
It lingers. It extends, I think, the flavors of the Bloody Mary.
Yeah.
Instead of just, boom, tomato, vodka, your spices and things in there.
Oh, Brendan, this is an ingenious concoction.
Just a little bit of, and it makes more sense because, well, you know, the history of the Bloody Mary, like a lot of cocktails, there are a lot of
stories
about where it came from. Some people say Harry's Bar in Paris. In Chicago, there was a story of a vodka and tomato juice cocktail called the Bucket of Blood. It was also known as the Red Snapper, which was originally basically just vodka, tomato, lemon. I think maybe eventually they added salt, pepper, and Worcestershire to it.
But always vodka.
Yeah.
Boy, this is interesting.
I just think this also, but you know, the name Bloody Mary, a lot of people, so one person who claims that they named it after their daughter or something like that.
Or the song from South Pacific.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's older than that.
But also people like to say that it's Mary Tudor.
Have you seen recipes that call for scotch? Is this your own idea?
I can't recall where I got it from or if I put it in my head. I just think it makes sense.
It makes it a lot more interesting. I'll give you that. How do people respond to that? And do you tell them when you're going to serve them a Bloody Mary? The B&O American Brasserie Bloody Mary involves some peaty scotch.
So we do have a Bloody Mary on the menu for brunch that involves peaty scotch. So you can actually see it on the menu and order it. It also involves a Old Bay infused vodka. So it kind of kicks up that little hint of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
But people really like it. A couple years ago, one of the other publications in town gave us a Best Bloody Mary. So it's definitely a very flavorful one that's very fun.
So if you want to make your Bloody Mary a little more interesting, you have a bottle of scotch in the house, especially on the peaty side,
the smoky side. Something from Islay, spelled like Islay, I-S-L-A-Y,
right.
Is pronounced Islay.
I-S-L-A-Y, single malt scotch. This is a 10-year-old.
So if you ever want to try something a little different, do something fun, you know, put your culinary skills to the test, blend up some tomatoes, some fresh tomatoes, put it in a strainer, line it with cheesecloth, pour it over real slow, let it drip into some kind of large container at your house that will catch it all, and let it sit overnight. And man, it is delicious.
Now I'm getting really creative here and thinking I'm going to take some fresh tomatoes this summer and some garlic.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe some cucumber.
Oh, yeah.
And blend it all up almost like a pureed gazpacho.
Yeah.
And see where that goes, where that takes me into a Bloody Mary world.
Yeah, I think that sounds great.
I'm going to try that.
I would say do it. Add just a squeeze of lemon into it to keep it bright.
Yeah.
That little bit of citrus, the citric acid in the citrus, will send those flavors.
Even lime, maybe?
Lime will probably do the trick as well.
But I think you're right about the citrus. It's got to be there.
I mean, it's like the seasoning for food, like salt on food. Citrus helps carry those flavors, continue them, and preserve them a little bit.
Okay, all we need now is the Eggs Benedict with our Bloody Mary.
Absolutely. I love some Eggs Benedict.
Some bacon and eggs. Okay, thank you, Brendan.
Thank you, Dan.
Brendan Doerr attends bar at the B&O American Brasserie at Charles and Baltimore Streets, and he serves as president of the Baltimore Bartenders Guild. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. We thank you for listening to Roughly Speaking. We wish you a good weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.